guest this evening, and Roy, we're almost ready to vote you into associate membership because you've been here several times, but we're thinking about doing that. But Dr. Roy Fuller has been with our church on several occasions to lead us in a study of other religions, how we can come to a better understanding of other religions, how they approach God. He has led us in previous studies on Jehovah's Witnesses, on Mormonism, did a wonderful study on Islam, and has come to be with us last week, this week, and then again next Wednesday night to look at Judaism and Jewish-Christian relations. He is a very active member of the Highland Baptist Church, one of our sister Baptist churches, Kentucky Baptist Fellowship churches down in Louisville, Kentucky. He teaches at the University of Louisville. He is also an adjunct faculty member at Baptist Seminary of Kentucky, and we're just delighted to have Roy with us. So I'm going to ask God's blessing upon our study, and we're going to turn things over to Dr. Fuller. Thank you, good folks, for coming very much. We appreciate it. Let's pray together, shall we? Thank you, Lord, for the opportunity to learn, and thank you for gifting teachers like Dr. Fuller who are willing to use their gifts to teach us and to dialogue with us. We give thanks tonight for our Jewish brothers and sisters, and we pray that you would use the study that we've had together on Wednesday evenings that we might have a better understanding of them, and at the same time have them have an opportunity to have a better understanding of us, as we have so much in common. For all that you do for us, God, we give you thanks. Thank you for everyone who's come. We entrust Dr. Fuller now to your care, and we pray in Christ's name, amen. So, Roy?
Well, good evening. It's good to be back with you all again. Appreciate your all's willingness to come out. We talked last week about, really, what we talked about last week was the development of what I called Rabbinic Judaism. Rabbinic Judaism was really the response to the crises of the destruction of the Second Temple. Second Temple was destroyed. That was a catastrophe. And it meant that there would be no more temple system, no more priesthood functioning, offering animal sacrifice at that one temple. And so as a result of that catastrophe and that crisis, the Pharisees, who were the teachers before the crises, developed Rabbinic Judaism. So that's just a little bit of a reminder. If you'd hit the next slide for me, please. And we looked at this last week, but just as a refresher, what they were doing with Rabbinic Judaism. And, of course, they replaced the temple. The one temple was replaced by synagogues. And synagogues could be held anywhere, could be had anywhere. The rule was when you had 10 Jewish men in your community, you could have your own synagogue. Sacrifices, which could no longer be practiced, were replaced by the study of Torah. I mean, this sounds like a teacher came up with it, if you ask me, but that's, you know, they came up with it. They said study is good, right? Priests were replaced by rabbis. They said, you know, we're fighting for land. If we keep fighting for land, the Romans may kill all of us. And so they said, we're going to abandon the need for land. We don't need land. For centuries, they had believed to be Jewish was to have a land. To be Jewish was to have a Jewish kingdom. The rabbi said, we're going to abandon that. And then they realized, okay, if Jews are scattered all over the place, we better standardize the language and what happens in all these synagogues. And so they did that as well. They standardized the Hebrew language. They standardized the liturgy, what happens in the synagogue. And then they said, okay, now, since we think this Torah is so important, it must be applied to everything. It has to be interpreted, they said. And so we need to give more guidance for Jews to interpret the Torah. They developed two new texts, the Mishnah and the Talmud. Now, these were previously known as the Oral Torah. They just wrote it down. Now it became the Mishnah and the Talmud. And we looked at an example last week, like the Sabbath laws, right? You know, it says in the Torah, keep the Sabbath on that day, you shall do no work, right? But nobody defined work. So the rabbi said, okay, we're going to tell you what work is. And so in the Mishnah, there are 39 categories of work, things that you should avoid doing on the Sabbath. And so this system was put in place, and it was really put in place over the span of several centuries. But by around 600 or so, this system was in place. And so this is where we're going to kind of pick up the story tonight. Next slide, please. We looked at this last week, the Talmud. And I noted how in the Talmud, if you see the Hebrew text there on the right, in the center of the page is the Torah section, a verse or a passage. And then around it, in those sort of, you know, columns out to the border of the page, that's commentary. That's interpretation. What the rabbis did was they said, okay, we're going to build a fence around the Torah. And a fence protects, right? So you don't violate it. You can't break those 613 commandments, but in order to not break them, you need to understand how to interpret them. And so that's what they produced. And it was a comprehensive system. There was nothing outside the scope of the Talmud. All parts of life. It wasn't just, we might think, oh, that's the religion, right? No, everything was encompassed in this. It was really their vision for, you might say, Jewish civilization. And so it's filled with all kinds of commentary. So now this brings us to some new ground. We're going to break some new ground here this week. Next slide, please. Go ahead and hit it again. Thank you. Over the span of about the next 300 or 400 years, up to around the year 1000 or so, so about 1,000 years ago, Rabbinic Judaism divided. Now, it didn't divide theologically or really even philosophically, but it did divide culturally. And so, next slide, please. There developed two different types of cultures for Judaism. One of these is known as Ashkenazic, or Ashkenazi. Ashkenazic Jews were Jews that were living primarily in Northern Europe, Eastern Europe, what becomes Russia. They were the ones that developed Yiddish. You probably heard of Yiddish, the Yiddish language. Yiddish is a combination of primarily Hebrew and German. Hebrew letters, but German sounds and accents and so forth. They developed Yiddish as their primary language that they spoke. They still used Hebrew but in the text, but they developed Yiddish. So there was a particular culture here. Again, it was a regional expression, mostly Northern Europe, Eastern Europe, and Russia. Ashkenazic Jews. Most Jews in the United States are actually out of this heritage. Because if you know our history of immigration, where have most folks immigrated from? You know, Eastern Europe especially. We had a lot of immigration from Eastern Europe and so forth. And so most Jews that came to the United States after 1800 were Ashkenazic Jews. Before 1800, they were the other type. If you could hit the slide again for me, please. They were Sephardic Jews. Now, Sephardic Jews really developed or originated in Spain. Sephardic is a word which means Spain in Ladino. And so this is a group of Jews that originated primarily in Spain or developed in Spain, this culture developed in Spain. And they eventually spread from Spain to places like Italy and North Africa and the Middle East. Most of this spreading, by the way, took place after the year 1492. Now, we all know the year 1492, right? You know, what was that poem? Columbus sailed the ocean blue? That kind of, okay. We all know 1492 as being a very significant year. Well, Jews also know 1492 as being a very significant year. Same year that Columbus stumbled into the Caribbean, the Jews of Spain were given a choice by Queen Ferdinand and Queen Isabella. They had just reconquered Spain from the Moors, and they said to all non-Christians, and this included Jews and Muslims, you have a choice. You can convert to Christianity or you may leave. Some converted, some pretended to convert, practiced their faith in secret. They became known as secret Jews. Some left, and they went to places like Italy, North Africa. I traveled to Morocco a couple times. If you go to Fez, Morocco, all the tour guides will tell you that in 1492, many Jews came to Morocco from Spain, and they were welcomed in Morocco. And they're quite proud of that fact. They'll tell you. They're quite proud of the fact that they welcomed Jews. So Sephardic Jews originated basically in the Iberian Peninsula in Spain, and they spread to these other places. They, too, developed their own language, Ladino. Now, Ladino is not nearly as well known as Yiddish. I'm not sure how much Ladino is used this today. I tried to find that information. I couldn't really find it. Yiddish had almost died out. Yiddish is now kept alive by the sort of ultra-Orthodox Jews, and we'll talk about them in just a moment. But so this is one way to think about Judaism. No divisions here really theologically. They all were rabbinic Jews. They all believed in the Talmud. They had some differences in practice. They had some differences in how they did some things. But there really wasn't any kind of a theological issue here that drove them apart. They just developed different cultural contexts and so forth. And so many Jews today are aware of this, and they can trace their lineage back to one of these two cultural types of Judaism. As I said, most Jews in the United States today are considered Ashkenazic Jews. Next slide, please. Now, some of you may recall last week I said that in Judaism, one of the reasons it's hard to define Judaism is because there's never been an agreed-upon set of beliefs, right? Well, that's true. There never has been a agreed-upon set of beliefs. But if there had been, this would be the closest thing. And this is what we're known. This was developed by Moses Maimonides, who was a Jew living in Spain in the 12th century, the 1100s, before he had to leave. And he went to Fez, Morocco. If you go to Fez, Morocco, they'll show you his house where he lived. It's still there. Moses Maimonides was the greatest rabbi of his time. And he developed what were known as the 13 Articles. And these 13 Articles, we could consider them like a creed. In other words, these were things that Jews were expected to believe. And so there you have your list. We won't go through all of those, but obviously some significant ones you would sort of take for granted or assume. Belief in the existence of God makes sense. Belief in God's unity. Jews were monotheistic. They believed God was one. The belief in God's non-corporality. That's a great theological word. Just means God doesn't have a body. God is spirit, you know. Belief in God's eternity. Again, these are all pretty standard fare. You know, we would really, from a Christian perspective, we would affirm all of these, certainly. God alone is the object of worship. Revelation is through the prophets. Moses is the greatest prophet. That's always been held in Judaism. Moses is the greatest prophet. I'm not sure Christians always appreciate Moses as a prophet. We see him in a lot of roles, but Jews have always regarded Moses as the greatest prophet because it was through Moses that the Torah was delivered. So he's the greatest prophet. The law was given at Mount Sinai, of course. The immutability of the Torah. The Torah does not change. Now, this is in the 12th century. Maimonides says the Torah is immutable. It's unchanging. Now, in just a couple of minutes, we're going to see how Jews decided that, maybe not. Maybe it could be changed. So we're going to get to that in just a minute. God's foreknowledge, divine reward and retribution, coming of the Messiah, that was a very important belief that Jews had held for many centuries. And Maimonides included it here, and the resurrection of the dead. And so, you know, if you were to go back and to this time, most Jews would have probably affirmed these kinds of beliefs. And many Jews today would still affirm these beliefs. The Jews that would affirm these beliefs in this format today probably fall on the more orthodox end of the scale. And again, we're going to talk about the modern branches of Judaism tonight. So we'll kind of see how Jews continue to divide. As we all know, many groups divide. We should know this better than most groups. We're Baptists. Baptists divide over everything, right? So, you know, Jews have done the same sorts of thing. Not as many times as Baptists have, but next slide, please. So this brings us up then to sort of the modern era. By modern era, I mean like 1800 to the present. Prior to 1800, all Jews really, for all practical purposes, were Orthodox Jews. Orthodox meaning correct or right, you know, right technically meaning right worship, but we think of Orthodox today meaning right beliefs. So prior to 1800, while there had been some small splinter groups that came off of Judaism, by and large, prior to 1800, almost all Jews could really be considered to be Orthodox Jews. They weren't even called Orthodox Jews. They were just called Jews, the rabbinic Jews. They named themselves Orthodox, or began to name themselves Orthodox, after the early 1800s, because it was in the early 1800s that your second branch, or your branch emerged there, and that branch was known as Reform Judaism. Not Reformed. I always tell my students, it's not Reformed, Don't write Reformed Judaism. It's Reform Judaism. They're a little touchy about it every once in a while. Reform Judaism. Reform Judaism began in the early 1800s in Germany. These German Jews wanted to be more fully assimilated into German society. They wanted to be seen as good German citizens, just like everybody else who happened to be Jewish. Rabbinic Judaism, in some ways, when you think about it, was a system that, if you followed it, you ensured the survival as Jews, but you also assured that you would be separate from society, right? The whole point was to be set apart. These Jews in Germany, they said, you know what? We don't want to be so set apart. We want to be assimilated. And so they developed Reform Judaism. And the biggest thing they did was they looked at the Torah and they said, this Torah contains two types of commandments. Moral commandments, like, well, the Big Ten, you know. Adultery, lying, that kind of thing. You got to keep those. You always got to keep those. Those are absolute. They're eternal. You got to keep those. But the Torah also contains what they called ceremonial laws, like the dietary laws, for instance, and other kinds of laws. They said, you know what, those were relevant and important at some time in the past, but they're no longer relevant and important for us. If you want to keep them, great. If you don't, great. They're optional. They're optional. So what have they done? They took the Torah and they divided it into two. Now, can they get away with this? Well, some Jews said, you can't do that. And the Reformed Jews said, watch us. Watch us. We will. So this develops in Germany in the early 1800s. Comes to the United States pretty quickly. Reformed Judaism comes here. I'll talk more about each branch in just a moment. And then, of course, so now at this point, you've got two branches, right? You've got a new branch called Reform, which I guess we could characterize as liberal. They were more willing to change, and so forth. They were liberal Jews, you might say. And then you've got the traditional branch that calls themselves Orthodox. This meant for many Jews that you really had you had a choice. You could stay traditional, or you could go way out here and embrace these liberal Jews who were really throwing out a lot of things. And many Jews were uncomfortable with those two choices. And so, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, really in America, the conservative branch was formed. And the conservative branch is right in the middle. You've got the Orthodox, the Reform, and the conservative, right in the middle. And they literally are in the middle. They hold on to tradition, but they're willing to make changes, just not as fast as the Reform are, usually. So, next slide. You know, I was, you know, when I made this PowerPoint, I was a little concerned that I was putting too much text on there, so I apologize. That may be hard to read. It's hard for me to read. It's really small in my paper here, but I apologize for that. Let me talk a little bit for a few minutes here about Orthodox Judaism. Now, I don't think there's an Orthodox synagogue here in Lexington. I think you have a Reform synagogue and a Conservative synagogue. If I'm wrong, please correct me. I don't think there's an Orthodox synagogue here. In Louisville, we have five synagogues. We have one Orthodox, we have two Conservative, and two Reform. So we kind of have the whole spectrum there. The Orthodox branch of Judaism. In a way, you could simply refer to these as the traditional Jews. They are traditional Jews, meaning they are traditional Jews in the rabbinic sense. They believe the Torah is immutable. You can't just sort of pick and choose. It doesn't change. You continue to interpret it. That can happen. You can continue to interpret the Torah because you need to do that. I'll give you an example. Let's say, let's go back to Sabbath laws, right? Because we talked about the Sabbath last week. On that day, you shall do no work. The rabbi said, okay, that means you can't travel very far, right? And they decided how far you could travel and so forth. Well, along comes the automobile. How far can you drive your car on the Sabbath? Can you drive your car on the Sabbath? Should you drive your car on the Sabbath? No cars in the Torah. Somebody's got to decide this, right? Who's going to decide? Well, when cars start coming on the scene, Jews were going to their rabbi saying, what about this car? Can I drive it to the synagogue on the Sabbath? Somebody's got to render an opinion about this. And so these opinions are known as responsa. They're published. You can find them online. It's the opinion usually of a rabbi. It doesn't have to be a rabbi, but usually it's an opinion of a rabbi on a moral or ethical question. They look at the Torah, they look at the Talmud, and they render their opinion, their judgment. I'll give you another example. Let's say you're a Jewish couple and you know there's this new technology that's come along, in vitro fertilization. You're having trouble conceiving a child. You want to know, we're practicing Jews. Is it okay for us to make use of this new technology to conceive a child? Again, where do you go? You go to your rabbi. No in vitro fertilization in the Talmud. It's not there. So he or she's going to render an opinion. So this is how that process of interpretation continues. And the rabbis envision this. It's pretty clear. The rabbis envision that this is how it would work. You would take this text, which doesn't change, and you would interpret it and apply it to new situations, just like we do our laws, right? And so that's what they were doing. And so the Orthodox hold on to this idea. The Orthodox believe that there are 613 commandments. The Orthodox believe that the whole system of Mishnah and Talmud must be followed and so forth. And they believe in some other things that we saw in that earlier slide. They continue to believe, for instance, in the afterlife. They believe in the bodily resurrection of the dead. If you go to an Orthodox service, it'll be very obvious to you that you are in an Orthodox service. Orthodox Jews have always separated men and women in the service. Men sit on one side, women sit on the other. If you go to the Orthodox synagogue in Louisville, men are sitting on one side, women are sitting on the other. They're all in the same room, but there's a divider down the middle of the room, and they're separated. It's always been that way in Orthodox Judaism, and it still is that way. They have not changed it. In Orthodox Judaism, rabbis are men. There's no provision for women to be a rabbi in the Talmud. And so they continue to hold on to that claim that rabbis should be men, for instance. So they are, you could say, Orthodox Judaism is traditional Judaism. Sometimes they use a different word today. They'll call themselves modern Orthodox. So they're willing to adapt some elements of culture, but they do not believe that the commandments can be changed or altered. They don't believe you can do what the Reform do and divide the Torah into mandatory and optional sections. Certainly that is true. And historically, at least, they have always been very opposed to intermarriage. Now, of course, this is something that goes way back to the rabbis. The rabbis, when they were setting this system up, they said, okay, listen, we've got to pay attention to this. That makes sense, doesn't it? If you don't pay attention to marriage, if you are promoting the cause of intermarriage, you will lose your distinctiveness. Their whole concern was maintain your separateness, right? So they've always consistently been opposed to intermarriage. And of course, this is a big issue in the Jewish community. I'll talk more about this next week. But intermarriage is a big issue because, you know, Jews live as a minority just about everywhere in the world. Many Jews fall in love with non-Jews. Many Jews marry non-Jews. And so intermarriage is a big, big issue in Judaism today. Again, I'll talk more about that next week. This slide, I wanted to go a little bit further into sort of the subtypes of the Orthodox, because not all Orthodox are the same. They all agree on the basic points, but they're not all the same. So there you see the modern Orthodox. That's what a lot of Orthodox call themselves today, modern Orthodox. They integrate into society. They don't have separate or distinctive dress. You know, you can't look at a modern Orthodox Jew and say, well, they're dressing in a different way. They dress like everybody else dresses and so forth. They do feel that the secular parts of life can be incorporated into life. In other words, they don't believe in separating themselves from society. So they're called modern Orthodox for this reason. Now, there's another subset of the Orthodox known as the ultra-Orthodox. You don't see too many of the ultra-Orthodox in the United States. They are more prominent in Israel. Ultra-Orthodox can be very, very religious. They tend to all be pretty religious, we might say. Life revolves around study of Torah, family, prayer, and so forth. They tend to have large families. This is one of the tip-offs on ultra-Orthodox. They tend to have large families. Modern Orthodox, Not necessarily. The birth rate for modern Orthodox in the United States is pretty much the same as for everybody else. So ultra-Orthodox tend to have large families. They also tend to live in a little more isolated style communities. They tend to be a little more withdrawn from society. And again, in Israel, you see this more in Israel than you do here, I would say. Now, next slide. Now, a lot of you probably have heard of like the Hasidic Jews, or the Hasidim, as they're called, the Hasidic Jews. Hasid means pious. Hasidic Judaism is a movement which began in the late 1700s. They are Orthodox. Hasidic Jews are Orthodox Jews. All Hasidic Jews are Orthodox Jews. Not all Orthodox are Hasidic Jews. That makes sense? They are Orthodox. Some people call them Orthodox. Some people call them ultra-Orthodox. Some people call them fundamentalist Jews. We can kind of relate to that term, you know, fundamentalist type of religion. It was founded in the late 1700s, really in Ukraine. It became a very dominant form of Judaism in Eastern Europe. I guess one of the best ways to think about it, the Hasidic Jews, is that what they did was they preserved Orthodox Judaism and a particular type of Eastern European culture, including distinctive dress. These are you see the men that wear the long black coats, the big black hats, they're the Hasidic Jews. They often have the long side locks or the payas. You know, you see the long lock of hair hanging down right here in front of the ear. They'll sometimes put it behind the ear, but they're very distinctive. Women dress very conservatively, long skirts or dresses usually. Many of their women wear wigs out of the belief they should cover their real hair. So they dress very conservatively. They do have large families. The things that set apart the ultra-Orthodox or the Hasidic Jews is... And really, I should go back and say, this was a movement that began in opposition to what had happened in Judaism in Europe. What had happened in Judaism over the centuries was, if you go back and look what the rabbi said, what's the most important thing you should do? Study Torah, right? Study. We all know that education can be expensive, right? That's not a new thing. Sometimes you don't have the luxury of sitting around the yeshiva or the academy and studying all the time. And so what had happened in Judaism in the Middle Ages was that it got very intellectual, it got very elitist. If you weren't educated, well, you were just not quite as good a Jew as everybody else. And so along comes the Hasidic movement and says, you know what? Education is a good thing, but it can be overemphasized. And so they wanted, they're kind of like a, you know, I sometimes compare them to charismatic. Anyone know what charismatic Christians? Hasidic Judaism was a movement that was about joy, it was about celebrating life, and in fact their worship is very invigorated, they dance, they sing, they are very enthusiastic, they believe you should try to be close to God all the time. They're really mystics in that sense. They're like, it's a mystical movement, believing that you should strive to be close to God. They call their rabbis rebbes. The Rebbe. They give their Rebbes a lot of authority, a whole lot of authority. You would never get married to someone, well, two things about marriage. All their marriages are arranged. All the Hasidic marriages are arranged. This is true to this day, even in the United States. All Hasidic marriages are arranged marriages. You go to your matchmaker, there's no dating. You go to your matchmaker, she makes a match, and then the marriage happens after that. The Rebbe would be consulted on this. They don't make any important decisions without going to the Rebbe. So I don't know, Bob, if they want to make you the Rebbe around here or not, but not yet. and it's going to be a he because they're Orthodox, right? No female Rebbes. He has a lot of authority. As I said, it was kind of a protest movement. It is a small, relatively small movement within Judaism. I think this is the right number. I think in the United States, you've got about 250,000 Hasidic Jews in the United States. Most of them live in the Northeast. A lot of them live in the New York area, the New York State area. Some of you have probably heard of the Lubavitchers. They are a type of Hasidic Jews. Hasidic Jews are all broken down according to their village. Lubavitch was a village. Now it's the name of the group. You have Lubavitch, you have Satmar, you have Gur, you have a bunch of these different groups. Lubavitch is probably the best known because they are a very missionary-oriented group. Now, when I say missionary-oriented, they're not trying to make non-Jews into Jews. That's not what they're doing. They're trying to make Jews into Hasidic Jews. That's what they're trying to recruit for. I had an experience with this. A few years ago, I went to Washington, D.C. with a group of leaders from the Jewish community in Louisville. I was the only non-Jew in the group. And we were going to this big rally in Washington, D.C. on the steps of the Capitol. It was a big rally there, and it was a very Jewish rally. I mean, just about everybody there was Jewish, you know. And so I was kind of, I went along for the ride. I was observing this phenomenon. And I was, there we are on the steps of the Capitol, and I see these young men going through the crowd, and I can tell by the way they were dressed that they were Hasidic Jews. And they were passing out their literature. They were missionaries, you know. One of them comes up to me, and he starts talking to me, and I should tell you. I said, I'm not Jewish. And as soon as I said that, he stopped mid-sentence and turned around and walked off. Now, I wasn't offended because I knew he wasn't interested in me because I wasn't Jewish. He was trying to find Jews who weren't very connected to their faith to convert them to Hasidic Judaism. Hasidic Judaism sees themselves as being on a mission to save Judaism from itself, essentially. They are very opposed to, the, you might say, the more modern developments in Judaism, and so they believe they have a mission. And so even though this is a small movement today, because of their high birth rate, they could become a significant force in Judaism. I read a book a couple years ago which said that if their birth rate holds up, they often have 8-10 children per family. It's not unusual at all. So with their large birth rates and the low birth rate of the other Jewish groups, they could become a significant force in Judaism, and that'll be a very interesting development if that occurs. It'd be an interesting thing to watch. Now, they play a significant role in Israel, the nation of Israel. There are more of them in Israel. They have a higher percentage there, and they're quite well connected politically in Israel. And they tend to be very conservative in their politics and in their religious outlook and so forth. So I don't know if we have any Lubavitch, much Lubavitch here in Lexington. We have a small number of Lubavitch Jews in Louisville. Hasidic Jews are there. They go to the Orthodox synagogue. They don't have their own synagogue, but they go to the Orthodox synagogue. And whenever I visit with the Orthodox synagogue out there, I notice there's an increasing number of Hasidic Jews there in Louisville. And I asked the question, I said, why are Hasidic Jews coming to Louisville? I was just kind of curious about it. And they said, they found that the cost of living is lower here than where they lived, you know. So people move for all kinds of reasons, you know. But they're probably one of the more visible subsets of the Orthodox. As I said, modern Orthodox are very assimilated into society. Hasidic Jews tend to be pretty separated from society. They don't have TVs in their home. They don't send their children to college. They don't believe in college. The problem they have with college is that, you know, in college you're putting young people together with people of the opposite gender, and that doesn't work for them. So they don't believe in college. They don't send their children to college. All their marriages are arranged and so forth. They tend to speak Yiddish. A lot of the older folks, especially in the Hasidic community, speak Yiddish as their primary language, actually. They still publish Yiddish newspapers. You can see them in places like New York and Williamsburg and places like that up in the Northeast. Next slide, please. So we talked about Reform Judaism. Let me go back and pick up that thread a little bit. Reform Judaism affirm the important central beliefs of Judaism, they argue. God, Torah, and Israel. But what they say they do is that they are the innovators. They are willing to make changes to update Judaism, to modernize Judaism. This grew out of their desire to be more assimilated into society. They didn't want to be so separate anymore. If you follow the rabbinic tradition, you are going to be separate. And they said, we don't want to be that separate. And so they developed Reform Judaism. They did take a different approach to the Torah, as I said. They believe the Torah is divinely inspired, but that it was written in the language of the time. That, in other words, that there's a human element in it. I think we can relate to this discussion. I mean, certainly in most churches, we have something like this discussion, right? When it comes to our own scriptures. What's the divine element? How is it inspired? Was there a human role? I mean, these are questions we would all ask as people of the book, right? So the Reformed Jews said it is divinely inspired, but it has a human element as well. They feel free. They gave themselves permission to adopt the Torah, to negate parts of the Torah, to say simply, that is no longer binding on us, or it's optional if you want to make it optional, and so forth. And so this is the permission they gave themselves. They have tended to be, for the last, 150 years or so, the innovators in Judaism. They were the innovators. Originally, when this movement took off in the early 1800s, they threw out the dietary laws. They said, we don't need that. It's not relevant. Nowadays, some Reformed Jews observe the dietary laws. So what's happened in the last, I'd say 50 years is very interesting. The Orthodox have become more liberal and the Reform have become more conservative. They're all recognizing the value of tradition. And so initially the Reform threw out the dietary laws, but now they still regard them as optional, but you find more Reform keeping the dietary laws. Reform Jews, in fact, you can go to the next slide. That's a little bit better, bigger print. One of the innovations of the Reformed Jews was they decided, hey, you know what? When we get together, when we have our service on Sabbath or Shabbat, we should have it in the language that we speak every day. Let's have it in the vernacular. We don't have to have it all in Hebrew. And so this was a big innovation because services had always been in Hebrew. And so they said, no, we can have it in other languages. So, of course, it began in Germany. Said that they began to have sermons. Sounds Christian, doesn't it? They began to have sermons. The Jewish liturgy didn't really have sermons before this, but now they had sermons. They put in pulpits. They put in organs. I kid my Reform rabbi friends. I said, you guys were becoming Protestant. Pulpits, organs, and they laugh too. They know they understand. You know, they get it. They were. What they were doing, they were saying, hey, you know what? Here we are in Germany, and there's all these different times of Christians in Germany, and that's your religion, and we want you to understand that this is our religion, but it's not any more than our religion. It's just like your religion, only a little different. That's what they really wanted. They didn't want to be seen as so separate, so they embraced all these changes, using the vernacular language, adding sermons, adding the organ, which for some Jews was just an abomination, but they put the organs into the synagogues, built these beautiful synagogues that look kind of like Protestant churches. But they were the innovators, and they began to innovate in a couple of ways. A lot of you probably know, of course, you've heard of the bar mitzvah. Bar mitzvah is a sort of rite of passage, right? Young man, age 13, typically, can't happen at any age, but age 13 is the traditional age, goes through a ceremony in which he is responsible for reading the Torah section that week. So he's going to be there in the front, in the synagogue, reading the Hebrew passage, which of course means he's got to study Hebrew to do that. So it takes a lot of work. Bar, son, mitzvah, commandments. When you go through your bar mitzvah, now you are a son of the commandment. Now you're responsible for those commandments. You're a man. You're an adult. Prior to that, you're a kid, right? It's a rite of passage. There's provision for it, of course, in the Talmud and Mishnah, but there's no provision for girls. And the Reformed Jews said, hey, we have daughters. We want to recognize our daughters in the same way we recognize our sons. And so they created, I think back in the 1940s, I'm not sure of the year, a bat mitzvah. Bat means daughter. Same thing for girls traditionally age 12, boys traditionally age 13. As my daughters will tell you, Dad, girls just mature faster than boys do. I did not disagree with that. Bat mitzvah. Now, are the Orthodox going to have bat mitzvahs? Anybody? No. There's no provision, right? It's not in the Torah. It's not in the Talmud. So this is a good example of how the Reformed Jews were making adaptation. They began to believe, hey, men and women are equal. What a crazy idea. And so they said that we should have a ceremony for our daughters just as we do for our sons. And so they created a bat mitzvah. And so today you can go to bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah, you know, in the Reformed tradition. None in the Orthodox. They also were the ones that said, you know, and I think the first woman was not ordained until the 1970s, maybe early 70s. They said, hey, you know, why couldn't a woman be a rabbi? Well, of course, there's no provision for women to be rabbis in the Talmud, but they were willing to make these kinds of changes. And so beginning in the 70s, they began to ordain women. Now you have a lot of women serve as rabbis. If you go to one of the schools, you know, you see a lot of female students there. So in the Reform tradition. So they have been willing to embrace these kinds of changes. Intermarriage is an interesting one. I talked about intermarriage earlier. The Orthodox are always opposed to intermarriage. 30, 35 years ago, if you went to your Reform rabbi and said, Rabbi, I have fallen in love with a non-Jew. Will you bless our marriage? Can we get married in the synagogue? The rabbi would probably say, Mazel tov. Let's have a wedding. And the rabbi would officiate at the wedding. Today, if you go to your Reform rabbi and you say, I would like to get married in the synagogue and my partner is a non-Jew, they will probably say, oh, I wish you the best, but they will not marry you in the synagogue. Now, they'll welcome you. They will welcome you. And there are many interfaith couples in synagogues. But they decided a few years ago, you know, intermarriage is not helping us. Jews worldwide are very concerned about plateauing populations. And they looked at the study. They've done some studies on this, and they looked at intermarriage. This may be a lesson for us in here, too, as well. But they looked at intermarriage, and what they concluded was very often when a Jew marries a non-Jew, the children are raised maybe in both traditions, but they end up not being strongly affiliated with either. And that was of some concern to the Jewish leadership. So while they will accept couples who happen to be interfaith in their marriage, they won't bless the marriages anymore. So that's another sort of recent change that the Reform have kind of gone back to the earlier tradition. So now we've got Orthodox, we've got conservative. Next slide, please. Now, conservative means that they are trying to conserve their tradition. As I said earlier, they're kind of in the middle, really, in the middle, between the Orthodox and the Reform. They believe that tradition should be preserved unless there's a really good reason not to. You should keep it unless there's a really good reason not to keep it. And so it doesn't mean they're politically conservative. Sometimes people get that confused. But they are conservative in they're trying to conserve their values. Their attitude toward the Torah, I guess I would say it's similar to the Reform. They do believe the Torah is divinely inspired, but that there's also a human component to it. They believe that Jews should keep the commandments because they're valuable, and they bring holiness to your life, and so forth. They have, I would say, over the past 30 years or so, shown a willingness to be flexible. And I'll give you a good example. As we mentioned, women rabbis, right? In the early 70s, the Reform began to ordain women as rabbis. A few years later, the conservative made the same decision. The conservative also embraced the bat mitzvah ceremony for their daughters. So what you tend to see here is that the Reform kind of lead the way in making change, being progressive, whatever word you want to use, and the conservatives have been following them, albeit maybe a few years later. So the gap today, I would say, the gap is really between the Orthodox and everybody else. That's where the dividing line is. Now, I want to be clear, I don't want to suggest that there's no difference between the Reform and the conservative. My rabbi friends would really not like me to give you that impression. There are differences, but I would say that there are less differences today than there were 50 years ago. They are more alike today than they were 50 years ago. Many conservative Jews also, I didn't talk about the seating. I talked about the Orthodox seating, men on one side, women on the other. The Reform threw that out. They said, no, families can sit together. And then eventually the conservatives said, oh, yeah, men and women can sit together. And so they don't separate in the synagogues like the Orthodox do. They typically use more Hebrew in their service. The Reform use the least Hebrew. The conservative use more. And the Orthodox, if you go to an Orthodox service, it's pretty much all in Hebrew. like 98% going to be in Hebrew. So the amount of language, the vernacular they use varies a little bit as well. Next slide, please. A couple more points about the conservative Jews. We mentioned, if you recall, when we looked at those 13 articles from Maimonides, he said one of the beliefs was belief in the Messiah, right? Belief in the Messiah. Messiah is a Hebrew word, Mashiach, means anointed one. We know that. Some modern Jewish groups have interpreted that differently. The Orthodox Jews generally are still looking for a Messiah. They believe in the concept of a Messiah. They generally believe it will be a person who will reestablish or usher in the kingdom. That's pretty much their attitude towards the Messiah. Reform and conservative have a little more leeway on this. Some, you can probably, I'm sure, find some conservative Jews and maybe even some Reform Jews who would say, well, yes, they believe in the Messiah. But I think more commonly they would argue that they believe in a messianic age, that there will be some kind of age in the future in which the kingdom will be established, not necessarily by a person called a Messiah, but they believe in a messianic age. So they see it more as a symbol, I guess, is what I'm saying. So now there are some other groups. One group we have not talked about, really more of a political group. You may have heard the term Zionism or Zionist. Zionism was a political movement that really gained steam in the 1800s. It was a political movement. Remember the rabbis had said, we don't need land anymore? They had said, we don't need land anymore. But then, after centuries of being treated poorly, where Jews lived, we'll talk more about this next week, Jews began to say, well, you know, maybe we do need a land. Maybe we need a nation. Maybe we need a Jewish state. And so the movement, the political movement known as Zionism, began to take root in the 1800s. Some Jews at the time were very Zionist. They embraced it. They said, yes, we should have a Jewish state. Again, other Jews, especially the Reform, said no. That makes sense, doesn't it? The Reform wanted to be assimilated where they lived. They didn't want a separate Jewish state because they didn't believe there was a need for a separate Jewish state. So they were initially anti-Zionist. They did not believe in a Jewish state. Now, of course, is there a Jewish state today? Yes. There's a Jewish state today. And Jews worldwide are very supportive of Israel. You're hard-pressed to find a Jew today who would be opposed to the creation or the sustaining of a Jewish state. So once that Jewish state was in existence, Jews were very supportive of it. When it was an abstract, some thought it was a bad idea, perhaps. So there is a political movement known as Zionism. There are certainly some other political movements and some smaller religious movements. But by and large, if you understand that there's Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform, that pretty much covers the landscape. And in America, the biggest groups are the Reform and the Conservative. They have about equal numbers, about 1.5 million each, I think, conservative Jews, and about 1.5 million Reform Jews, and then a smaller number of Orthodox Jews in America. Now, in Israel, it's kind of interesting, because in Israel, it's a Jewish state. And so in Israel, the Orthodox tend to call the shots, religiously speaking. There are two chief rabbis in Israel. They're both Orthodox. And so when religious matters come up, the Orthodox position often prevails in Israel, and this doesn't go down so well with the Reform and the Conservative Jews. Believe me, not all Jews are alike. They have many opinions, and you certainly see that if you look at Israeli politics. You certainly see that. Let me go to that. I think what is the last slide, and then we'll have some time for questions. I wanted to give you a sense of Jewish populations. These are the best numbers, the most current numbers I could find. I gave you the top 10 countries there. One of the things that immediately jumps out is that there are only three countries on that list that have more than 1% of their population is Jewish. The United States, a little over 2% Jewish, but notice that's almost 6.5 million Jews. Israel, which is a Jewish state, 75% Jewish, and Canada, which is a little over 1% Jewish. All the rest of those top 10 countries have less than 1% of their population is Jewish. And when you really break it down, it's pretty clear, isn't it, that a huge, huge chunk of the world's Jewish population is in two countries, right? Israel and the United States. What is that, 86%? 86% of the world's Jews live in either Israel or the United States. So it's those are the two big population centers. Largest Jewish city in the world is Tel Aviv. Second largest Jewish city in the world is New York City, in terms of numbers. So that gives you a little bit of sense. Jews are very concentrated. You can find small populations of Jews in many countries. Many countries have some Jews, but this is where the bulk of them are, overwhelmingly so. I don't know the Jewish population in Lexington. In Louisville, it's about 8,500. And it's been around 8,500 for a long time. They support five synagogues. They support a Jewish community center. They have a federation. It's a pretty active Jewish community. They worry, like a lot of Jewish communities worry, about shrinking size and numbers going down and things like that. But they have a high affiliation rate, which means that many Jews in Louisville are affiliated with a synagogue. Of course, you can be a Jew and not be affiliated with a synagogue. But many Jews in Louisville are affiliated. I just don't know the populations here in Lexington at all. Yeah. I don't know what explains that. I was kind of surprised when I looked these numbers up. I was well aware that the biggest population centers were Israel, the United States, and then I knew France and England and Canada, and I knew Argentina and Russia. But I was surprised about Australia. I wasn't surprised about some of the South American countries. There have been Jews in South America for a long time. There have been Jews in the United States for 350 years. They celebrated 350 years, I think, in 2007. Jews first came to the United States in 1657 when a boatload of Jews landed in New York Harbor. Where did they come from? Brazil. They had been in Rio de Janeiro. The colony had collapsed. They got on a boat and they came to New Amsterdam, which was being run by Peter Stuyvesant at the time. He wouldn't let them get off the boat. He didn't want them to get off the boat. He wanted them to go away. Then he found out that some of the stock owners in the colony back in Europe were Jewish. And they said, let them off the boat. So Jews have been in the United States for a long time, and they have thrived here. Jews regard the United States as a land of great opportunity. They have thrived here. And one of the reasons that they have appreciated the United States and France, those were the first two countries where Jews gained civil rights. Following the revolutions in France and the United States, that's where Jews began to be treated like citizens with equal rights. I know this sounds not so controversial today, but believe me, at the time it was very controversial. And so Jews have thrived in the United States. And so yeah, I don't know what explains that population of Jews in Australia. I'm not sure what explains that. Yeah, right here. Oh, yes. Yeah, these are post-World War II numbers. Yeah, you would have had a lot more Jews in Eastern Europe, Germany, Russia. I mean, you know, about 90% of the Jews of Germany were killed during World War II. Poland, which is not on this list, Poland had 3 million Jews in the 30s. There were 3 million Jews living in Poland in the 30s. Over 90% were killed during the war. So, yeah, this is dramatically different than what you would have had. And, of course, that was a huge impact on the population. I mean, in the 1930s, it was estimated that the world's Jewish population was about 18 million Jews in the 1930s, 6 million murdered during World War II. There were 9 million Jews in Europe, so two-thirds of the Jews of Europe were killed during World War II. So they have not yet made it back to 18 million. The world Jewish population now is somewhere, the number I see is around 15 million. Worldwide. So yeah, that was a huge event. Yeah, those numbers would be, in fact, the chart I looked at had numbers before the war and after the war. It's quite shocking in some countries. Yeah. Yeah. Right over here. Yeah. Yeah. Who are we dealing with? Well, Jews in America have a big interest in Israel, don't they? Of course they do. They are strong proponents for the state of Israel. They don't all agree on what's the path for Israel. Every once in a while, you see tensions between the Jewish community in Israel and the Jewish community in the United States. You see those tensions reflected at the government level, right? So, yeah, it gets interesting. It gets very interesting. I'll talk a little bit more about this next week, because one of the issues in Jewish Christian dialogue is Israel. What should policy be towards it? And, of course, over the past 20, 30 years or so in America, you've had this phenomenon that's sometimes referred to as Christian Zionism, Christians who are very supportive of the state of Israel. The Jewish community has embraced that movement, although some Jews are uneasy with that movement. So it gets really interesting at times when you start talking about Israel. Even among the Jewish groups, it gets interesting. I can tell you, I didn't talk about conversion, but of course, it's always been possible to convert to Judaism, right? Jews have always welcomed converts. And there was a procedure laid out in the Torah and the Talmud for conversion. Now, as you might imagine, some of these modern branches altered their procedure. This means that, let's say you converted to Judaism here in Lexington and you became a Reformed Jew. Well, you're just as Jewish as someone who was born Jewish. Your children will be considered Jewish if you're a Jew. And there's no second-class Jews. You're all Jews. If you convert, you're Jewish. But let's say you go to Israel. Well, let's say you want to move to Israel. And Israel has a law which says that any Jew seeking citizenship can become a citizen automatically. Now, if you are a Reformed Jew and you converted to Reformed Judaism here in Lexington, if you go to Israel, they're not going to recognize that you're a Jew, because you didn't go through the Orthodox conversion procedure. This got so hot a few years ago that the Reformed Jews in America said, we are going to pull our support from the nation of Israel if you don't fix this. So, again, you kind of see how these issues can get quite heated. You know, very interesting thing about Israel, if you look at that population, 5.7 million Jews in Israel, the vast majority of those Jews they consider themselves secular Jews, meaning they might see themselves as culturally Jewish, but they're not very devout. They're not very practicing. The real conservative Jews in Israel, they would like to see a law in place which closes everything on the Sabbath. Everything should be shut down on the Sabbath. Do most Jews in Israel want everything to be closed on the Sabbath? No. No. So, you know, again, there are lots of different opinions about it, just about every conceivable issue. And sometimes it gets quite heated on both sides of the Atlantic here. You know, you got Jews in Israel, Jews in America, not always seeing things in the same way. They're always supportive of the concept of the nation. But once you get past that, particular policies sometimes get very, very divisive. And I'll try to talk a little bit more about that next week. I appreciate your question. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Oh, this is a great question. The question was here, the Hasidic Jews not believing in higher education, which they don't, and does this create a social economic problem? This creates a huge problem for them, because I've already said they got big families, and what are they doing? Here they've come to the United States, they're here in large numbers. They are cutting off their children from one of the best things that we offer. People from all over the world send their kids here. We have a great education system, higher education. They don't send their kids. So their kids are not doctors, lawyers, professions. They're cutting themselves off from that. Most Hasidic Jews will only take occupations that don't conflict with their faith. Now, a lot of them go into retail. Some of them, of course, become successful. There's a number of great success stories you could point to. But they are cutting themselves off from some of the best things, you know, some of the best kind of higher paying occupations. This is a problem. This is a problem for them. They mitigate it a little bit by their very close-knit communities, and they have a lot of social services they provide to their community. But it is a problem for them. These large families with, in many cases, one income, because the Hasidic Jewish mother, her role is to be a Jewish mother. That's a sacred role as far as they regard it. So not many of them work outside the home. So you got one income, and you cut yourself off from higher paying occupations. So yes, it absolutely is a problem, yes. When they need those kinds of services, doctors and lawyers, they tend to go to the Orthodox community. The Orthodox send their kids to higher ed in large numbers, and so they go to the Orthodox for those services. But they can't provide them for themselves, and they cut their kids off from it. So yeah, it is a problem, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, good question. Other questions? I know our time's running out, but I think we can take one more perhaps. Any other questions? Way back there, I see you, yeah. Oh, I don't know. I read he was Jewish. Does anybody know? I don't know. There was a time when that would have been more revealing than it is. I can tell you, if you go to a Reform synagogue, you'll see men wearing kippahs or yarmulkes. Non-Jews don't have to wear them in a Reform synagogue. If you're a non-Jew and you go to an Orthodox synagogue, they will ask you to wear one. He might if he was a modern Orthodox. I mean, it's possible. I mean, people do marry outside the faith. You just can't get a rabbi typically to bless it. I mean, but they were married. They had a huppah there, I think, didn't they? The canopy. I think they had a huppah there. But I mean, they were using symbols from Jewish marriage ceremonies. So they had both. I knew they had both clergy there. Right, right. I'll try to find out for next week. Yeah, from People Magazine, a very authoritative source, yeah. On this it is, yes. Well, thank you all so much. Again, next week we will deal exclusively with issues in Jewish-Christian relations, and I want to talk about a couple things. Notably, I want to talk about the whole history of anti-Semitism, which is a big issue, but there's a lot of other issues as well, so that's what you have to look forward to next week. We'll talk about a lot of issues in the current dialogue between Jews and Christians. All right, I'll turn it back to Bob.